I'd like to start from the beginning. Please correct me if any of my facts are wrong, but I read that you started working for William Hill 1972 as a board marker and progressed from there.
Yeah.
Is that correct? And how did you get involved with betting shops in the first place?
That's absolutely correct. At the time, I was working for my father as a navvy on his building site. He was a foreman on a building site. My dad was a master bricklayer. I can't put one brick on top of another. I was out of work from my previous job on the local newspaper. And I'm having been out in the wilds of northwest London in Hendon, lifting every breeze block on this building site, I'd had enough of that. I really had. It was the middle of November. It was cold, it was wet, and I think this was part of my dad's master plan. And I spotted an advert in our local paper for a board marker in a William Hill betting shop in St Anne's Road, Harrow. And I went for the interview, got the job, I think basically because I could tell the difference between 6-4 against and 6-4 on. Handed my dad the donkey jacket, and my new employment began March 1972, yeah.
So were you a punter then? Were you involved, were you actually involved with betting?
I liked a small wager. I'd had some bookmaking experience when I was at school and was almost expelled for running a book on the FA Amateur Cup, in which my local team, which I still support today, Wealdstone, had reached the final, where they played Hendon in the final and won. Fortunately for me, my book was confiscated before the match could be played, and therefore any punter that couldn't produce proof that they'd had a bet was unable to collect. So that saved me from bankruptcy, and probably that's what saved me from expulsion as well. I think the deputy headmaster who rumbled me, I think he'd backed Hendon.
So you moved through the ranks to manager, but then it's a fair jump from manager to becoming PR guru. How did that come about?
Yeah, I really enjoyed being a board marker, and it's a shame that job doesn't exist any longer. I think there may well be one or two around the country. Enjoyed it, was pretty quickly put onto a settling course though. In those days you could do that very quickly. And I was picking up how to run a shop just by being in it, and I came into work one morning as a settler. I was in a shop round the corner from the other shop in Harrow, which the company had at the time, and the manager in the shop that I was working in said to me, "You better go round and manage the shop round the corner." And I said, "Why is that? What's the matter with John? Is he ill?" "No," he said, "he's vanished, and so have the contents of the safe. I don't think we're likely to see either again," he said. So I went round there, and I was sort of by default then the manager. And another job I really enjoyed, great job running a betting shop. But I'd always wanted to be a journalist, that was my background, and after couple of years running the betting shop, I saw an advert in the Sporting Life for somebody to work in William Hill's advertising and press office as such department. They didn't really have a department called public relations in those days. I applied for the job. I think I had to write to the Sporting Life to apply for the job. Went for an interview with, bemusingly enough, the managing director of the company at the time, Sam Burns. I had no idea what he was doing interviews for a job like that. And sat in front of him. He had my CV in front of him. Looked at it, said, "There's a mistake here. It says you already work for us." He said, "That's a bit previous." I said, "Yes, I do. I run one of the William Hill betting shops." "Ah," he said, "well, in that case, I suppose I better offer you the job." So that was it. I'd got the job in the advertising department, as it then was. Was in there within a week or so. At the time, the main essence of the job was partly to take care of the day's advertisements in the Sporting Life and the Sporting Chronicle. Also to give out the latest horse race betting information to those papers, contact trainers to ask them about their plans for the horses, that sort of thing. With my own journalistic background at that point, I started to ask why we only worried about horse racing publicity when there were a lot of newspapers out there who I thought would be willing to write about bookmaking and betting, given the right stories to do so. And I was basically told, "Well, if you think that, you better get on with it." And so I did.
So you've been given the carte blanche to pretty much do what you want, by the sound of it. So what was your first move?
Well, my first move was to try and compete with Ron Pollard, who at the time was Ladbrokes' PR man, and he'd created a little niche market for himself betting on Miss World and the weather, which was getting some coverage. And I thought, if he can do that, why can't we do that? And I thought, if you're going to try and compete with somebody, copying is not enough. You've got to improve on what they're offering. So in terms of the weather, I went to the Met Office and said, if we asked you to confirm for us whether it snowed at any time during the 24 hours of Christmas Day anywhere in the country, could you do that? And they said yes, they could, because at that time Ladbrokes offering was that it had to actually be snowing at midday on the roof of the London Weather Centre for them to pay out on a white Christmas. So immediately we were able to enhance the offer that they had, and so we did that. And the other thing that he was doing, as I said, there was the Miss World competition. There was no reason why we couldn't get involved with that as well. In those days, it wasn't politically incorrect to bet on the outcome of Miss World. I don't think many companies bet on it now, although some still do. And then basically, my plan was to scan the tabloid newspapers, see what they were writing about, see if there's a bet that could be attached to it, and if there was, get it out there. And also to look for once at letters which came into the company, which previously were being thrown away from people who were saying, well, can I either bet on my kid to grow up to play football for England, whatever it may be. And so we started to take them. A, it was money coming into the company. B, it was a story to give to, if only the local paper, for that child to win Wimbledon or to win a cap for England, whatever it may be. And then these things started to take off, and eventually the weather expanded into betting on whether and when it would stop and start raining in London, those sort of things. 1976, if you probably don't remember, being much too young, we had a scorching summer. We were able to bet on when it would start raining again in London, which was almost unprecedented. And then 2 years later, 78, we had a stinker of a summer, and we could bet on when it would stop raining. So the weather has been, until these days, just an unquenchable opportunity for people to bet on. And even bookmakers don't get accused of fixing the weather.
So you soon ventured away from the weather. One of your most famous ones, a lot of people will be too young, unfortunately I'm not, who shot JR?
Absolutely, and I can't take all the credit for that. That was my wife, because I didn't even watch Dallas. And she was watching this program at home one day and then mooching around the place saying, well, it could be him who does it, it could be her who does it, it could be them who do it. I said, what are you talking about? What's going on? She said, well, this character, J.R. Ewing, the hated villain of the piece, is going to be assassinated at some stage, and nobody's going to be able to find out who did it. And I said, well, why won't they be able to? And she said, well, I believe it's going to happen right at the end of the series, and we're not going to find out until the next series starts. I'm like, well, it might be interesting, but surely that's going to be scripted. Probably not a lot we can do there. I then got a call from a guy called Richard Moore, if I'm not doing him wrong, from the Sunday Mirror, who said to me, listen, any possibility that you could open a book on Who Shot JR? I said, well, it's you as well, is it? You and my wife watch his programme. He said, not only, I said, it's the biggest news in television at the moment. I said, okay. He said, I'll guarantee you a centre spread in the Sunday Mirror with all your odds in if you'll do me some prices. And I said, surely there's got to be a problem. People will know who's going to have done it. It's TV, it's going to be scripted. He said, listen, it's the end of the series. They don't start filming the next series for another 3 months or so. Nobody's even signed contracts to be in the next series. Who knows who's going to be in it that it could be? So he said, I guarantee to you, at least at the moment, nobody knows the answer. I went to see my one above my boss, because my boss just laughed at me when I suggested it to him. He said, you'll get us all the sack, it'll cost a fortune. Went to see the director who looked after our department. He sat down, he said, no, impossible. I went to see him again, eventually got to the point where he said, okay, look, this is it. He said, you can do it. He said, if it works, it was my idea. If it doesn't work, you're out. I thought that was the best deal I was going to get, so I took it, and we did it, and it just proved sensationally popular. And we ended up, when the new series began in this country, it was enormous news. But even when they showed the edition in which JR actually was shot, I think that ended just as the BBC News was starting, and it was one of the lead items on the BBC News that JR had been shot. And they put up our odds. I mean, how could you get coverage on BBC News of odds on a tabloid programme? You couldn't do it today.
And who did shoot JR?
Kristen, I think her name was.
Was it Skinner?
She was second or third favourite. There were some people, I genuinely believe that never got out generally. There were a few people who had slightly larger bets than you might have expected for no apparent reason. But we took genuinely, this is in, what was it, 1979, 80, something like that. We took £250,000. That was serious money on a, you know, on a bet like that. And we paid out pretty much £250,000. So it was profit neutral, I think, as far as the company was concerned. But in terms of the free PR we got, you just could not have bought that. It's just impossible to buy that. And I should add, in light of things that happened today, we bought goodwill by doing that. People really enjoyed it. It was great. Everybody was speculating on it. And for us to be able to put odds on it gave people another way of looking at it. Everybody was saying, well, I think it's so and so because, and then somebody else would say, well, yeah, but the bookies don't think it could be possibly them. You can have 50 to 1 about him or her. So, you know, it brought a new angle to it. And there was, at the time, I can recall, no criticism of us doing it.
So that was obviously one of your spectacular successes. Were there any that really bombed or that you got tapped up on?
Oh, there's a lot. I think, you know, you sort of throw a lot of things out there and some get picked up and some don't. And of course, you very quickly forget the ones that you've thrown out there. I do remember one or two that cost us money for various reasons. You probably have to buy my autobiography for that when and if it ever comes out. But yes, they don't all work, and you shouldn't think they do, because otherwise you'd very soon be disabused of that fact. So of every 5 or 10 stories that you might put out, you'd be more than happy if one of them got picked up by a national paper. That in itself is a brilliant success rate.
So you are now, in hindsight, acknowledged as being an innovator in that sort of market. Do you think the betting industry appreciated it at the time?
Our rivals didn't, for sure. They didn't like it, and a number of them made it obvious that they didn't like it. And I suspect, basically, because we were getting, it was before they thought, well, perhaps we should do that as well. And in the light of what Ron Pollard had done, particularly for Ladbrokes, they should have kicked on. They didn't. When Ron retired, it was as though those sort of markets retired with him. Also, they thought nobody else would be able to do them for them, and they did have one or two good operators subsequent to that. But yeah, I think, as I say, it resulted in not only myself but the other people that work for bookmaking companies appearing on fairly mainstream television on quite a regular basis, being asked about their opinions on things and putting odds on them. And at the time, it certainly softened the image of the industry.
Politics was another big thing. If I've read my stuff correctly, for bets and things.
Yeah, politics again was one of Ron Pollard's specialities. Ron Pollard, of course, used to work for William Hill before he worked for Ladbrokes. And I think Ron took his idea for betting on politics to Ladbrokes because William Hill himself was very anti betting on politics. He thought it might influence people to vote in a different way for some reason. I think it was an illogical argument. And there was a famous, at the time, radio debate between William Hill himself and Cyril Steen at Ladbrokes, the managing director of Ladbrokes at the time. And Cyril was all in favour of betting on it. And William was trying to convince people that it was a bad idea to do it. And that didn't do the company any good. Now, William, sadly, had died a year or two before I joined the company. And so that his influence was still around, but it wasn't as strong. And Ladbrokes were by that point taking bets on general elections and stuff, but not doing much else. And I had a bit of an interest in politics, but which I decided to make a bigger interest because it drove me mad seeing, you know, the media writing about Ladbrokes' political odds. I thought, well, if they're doing it, we should be doing that and promoting it. And so we started to do that. And then it was around about the sort of time that my friend Screaming Lord Sutch came along and started the official Monster Raving Loony Party, and with whom we teamed up to sort of give an additional angle to political betting and to promote through. We actually ended up sponsoring the Loony Party. But political betting, even in those days, was a big deal. You know, you could seriously take five-figure bets on the outcome, particularly of the American election. We used to have a lot of Americans who couldn't, as they can not at this moment, bet on their own election in their own country. And we would have people literally flying over to this country on Concorde to bring money over to bet on the outcome of the US election, and we took some serious bets there. I did get a phone call once from a guy in Texas, and I won't try and reproduce his Texan drawl, but he had the archetypal one, in which he told me initially he would like to have a small bet on the outcome of one of the US elections. So I said, how small? He said, oh, only $3 million. I said, okay, we probably wouldn't call that small, and probably we think that's quite a lot of money for one person. And he said to me, well, hell no, man. He said, it ain't all for me. He says, there's three of us. But it was still a bit too rich for the size of our book. You know, although we were taking some substantial bets, we couldn't handle a $3 million bet.
And did he get it right, do you remember?
I guess he did, yeah, because most of the punters did get the American elections right. Most of the punters got most of the elections right up until relatively recently, didn't they, when it all started to go a bit pear-shaped.
Well, another of your good publicity stunts was Wogan's winner. I think Terry Wogan used to give a tip out every day.
He did.
And that sort of caught fire. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I won't claim any credit for that at all. I think that was something that the racing industry got itself together to suggest initially, either to the BBC or the producers of the Wogan show. But for whatever reason, we ended up sort of semi-sponsoring it. It wouldn't have been called sponsorship in those days. But certainly you made a point of finding out what his selections were and highlighting it in the shops and everything and encouraging people to get involved, because you were pretty sure that if it was a human being making the predictions, they were unlikely to be too successful in the long term. So we encouraged people to get involved as much as they could. And then we would feed back the stories of the people that did to the show, and one or two of the anonymous punters, as they were, who would turn up and just say, I want to bet back Wogan's winner, Wogan's wager at some time, I think it may have been called. And they would go through their little spell of being very successful, at which point, of course, we would slightly hype up the story and suggest that if they predicted another winner in the next day or two, we were likely to go out of business. Didn't quite happen that way, but yeah, they had some punters that were, and of course, as then, you were anonymous when you went into a betting shop, so people were literally coming in with bags full of money and saying, just stick it on Wogan's wager. Another thing that you can't see happening today.
So hand on heart, can you tell me that they really did used to walk in and have suitcases full of money on?
I can tell you hand on heart that in my 45 years working for William Hill, I only ever slightly invented one story, and that was absolutely nothing to do with anybody coming in and having a bet. And I never had to make up stories about the level of bets that we'd taken, because we'd taken the bets. I mean, the most famous example of that, I think, was £500,000 bet on Big Bucks, which people still to this day do not believe we took. We did. I mean, what more can I tell people? We did. Why would we have to make them up? People do have bets. Sometimes we can tell you who they are. Sometimes we can't tell you who they are because they don't want us to tell you who they are. But I never made any of those up. They were always true.
You mentioned your friend Screaming Lord Sutch. You've written a book about Screaming Lord Sutch, and if I'm correct, at least 32 other books. So you're quite prolific. When did the book writing start?
Obviously, once I realised I was no longer a true, in inverted commas, journalist, I wanted an outlet for my writing. And writing press releases was great, but it didn't quite satisfy my appetite to write. And I'd always wanted to write a book or two. And the first book that I was involved in actually was a Reddy Reckner. My boss of the time, Mike Raper, who's still around today, still a good friend, taught me a lot of what I know, was approached by the Sporting Life and with an idea. They wanted basically a simple Reddy Reckner with some editorial into, you know, to widen the appeal, some explanations of betting terms and bits and pieces. Anyway, I helped him with that, and believe it or not, the two of us literally, and I was going to say computed, but we didn't even have computers. We used a calculator, I think, to work out every combination of bets you could in the Reddy Reckner. You're like 13 to 8 times 15 to 8 on for a pound, whatever. Well, that we double checked every, it took us bloody months. But so we produced this Sporting Life, Eddie Reckner, as it was at the time, which in various incarnations has been in print pretty much ever since. It's had new covers, it's had new blurb attached to it, most recently published, I think, by Oldcastle Books. So there's the Gentleman's Guide to Winning Wagers, something of that nature. So I started with that. As you said, Screaming on Such was a pal of mine. When I started on the local paper as a journalist, he was local, not that far away from where we are now. He was a Harrow boy, and I was running the Harrow pages on the paper I was on. So anytime you needed a story and there was a gap in the paper with nothing to fill it, you would speak to Screaming Lord Such, who famously rang me up one day and said, "I've got a great story for you." "What's that, David?" I said to him. "Well, my house is on fire." He said, "It'll make a good picture." He said, "It'll make a great picture." I said, "How's it going to do that?" I said, "By the time we get there, it'll be out." He said, "It won't." I said, "What do you mean it won't?" He said, "I haven't found the fire brigade. I'll wait for you to get here." So I grabbed a photographer who didn't believe at all what I told him. Where we were. It took us about 20 minutes to get there. We got there, got to his house. There were his neighbours were standing around looking anxiously up where there was smoke coming out of the roof. David Such had a ladder up the wall and a bucket in his hand, and he said, "Oh good, I'm glad you've arrived." He said, "Right, I'm going to get up the ladder with this bucket to pour it on the roof," he said, "and then we can call the fire brigade." And blow me if that's not what happened. When I did come to write the book about him, after he committed suicide and died, I told this story so many times I thought I must have made it up, you know, eventually it can't have been that. And I went back and got the original story from the newspaper library at Colindale, which is no longer there, the original newspaper. And there it was, the picture of him doing that. That's exactly what he was like. He was a man who was consumed by the need to be recognised by as many people as possible. In fact, he said it in a BBC Two documentary once, on the Arena programme, I think it was, in which said the interviewer said to him, he said, "David Such," he said, "everybody in this country knows who you are." He said, "Why do you bother looking for more publicity?" He said, "Well, there's people being born every minute. They've got to know who I am as well." And that's what drove him.
So, Graham, talking about legends of music, some people might be a bit surprised with the backdrop. We're actually in a second-hand record shop, second scene in Bushy. And you've got a deep love of music, so I'm told. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm on the wrong side of the counter. I really, it's strange being this, because Julian, the owner, is usually here, and I'm standing there trying to convince him that I should have the record that I like for 15 quid rather than 20. And he's got all his rarer things up here. And this is one of my favourite haunts. I love this shop. I bought my first record in 1962. I recently found it. It was "Dance with the Guitar Man" by Duane Eddy. A wonderful twangy song, and I've been buying music ever since. I would probably be able to stand up, like in another context other people would do, and say, "Listen, I'm an addict. I cannot go more than a few days without buying a record." And that's what I do, and that's what I do in here quite a lot. I have not got a musical bone in my body in terms of playing music. I just love listening to it. And I particularly specialise in the mid to late 60s psychedelic period, which is the stuff that I love, and the stuff I'm still searching for the records that came out at that time that nobody knew about. I've got all the ones that everybody knew about. I'm looking for the ones that got ignored at the time, because that was the sort of music that I still like. I was a record reviewer on the local paper that I worked for, and that was in fact why I ended up being an ex-local paper reporter, all due to an Elvis Presley record. My editor of the time was a Greek lady, I hope you're watching this, Dina, somewhere, who loved Elvis Presley. She went on holiday, she said, "Elvis has got a new record out shortly." I said, "Yeah, you're right." She said, "Can I have it when it comes out?" I said, "Fine, I'll do the review, you can have it, I'm not an Elvis fan." She came back from holiday, "Have you got the Elvis record?" "No, RCA haven't sent it yet." "They must have sent it, because it's been out for a couple of weeks, it's in the charts." "Well, they didn't send it. If you want to ring them up and ask them." "No, you've probably kept it." I said, "Why would I have kept it, Dina? I'm not an Elvis fan." It descended into a bit of name calling after that, and with the result that I was summoned by the managing director of the newspaper to see him and ordered to apologise to the editor for the row reaching the proportions that it did. I didn't want to apologise. She didn't want to accept an apology anyway. So it was agreed that it would probably be best if I left. But I did win the industrial tribunal that subsequently followed. They were ordered to give me my job back, but Would you go back? No, you couldn't go back, could you?
So back to the subject of books. You tell me that you're possibly writing your next book is going to be about music. Can you tell us a bit about that, or is it still under wraps?
No, I haven't written it yet. I've started to write some of it. It's just that most of my books have had a gambling theme of some sort. As you said, I did one about Lord Such, and my most recent book was about Dorothy Paget, one of the most eccentric and wealthy women who ever lived in this country, and a huge gambler, huge racehorse owner, fantastic subject for a book. And if you haven't got Dorothy Paget, the eccentric queen of the sport of kings, you really should have a copy, and it'll be out in paperback from coinciding time with next Cheltenham, but you can still buy it for Christmas in hardback. I would love, now that I have more time on my hands, to write a book about the phenomenon of record collecting. And one of the ways, one of the ways in which I would like to compose that book is really to visit as many of the still existing and recently open secondhand vinyl shops in the country, of which I calculate there are probably around about 150. Nobody's got an exact list, and I don't think anybody's ever been stupid enough or had enough time on their hands to want to visit all of them. I've probably done most of those in and around London. I'm up to about 50 odd already. But along the way, I'd like to write about the various facets of record collecting. What makes a record like this, for example, worth £275 when you've never heard of it? I've only vaguely heard of it. Most people would never hear it, even if they've heard of it. And why would you pay £275 for that when you could buy the same thing on CD? I saw it the other day for £6.99. You'll have to read the book to find out the answers to why some people would do that. Why would I come in here and spend hours leafing through records looking for stuff I've never heard? And hoping, well, I can play it on Julian's record player over there. There are a lot of aspects to record collecting. I think, in a way, it is a form of addiction. I can't go more than a week or two without feeling the itch and wanting to go and buy some records. As we speak today, yesterday I was in a record shop in Cambridge called Black Barn Records, which I can only recommend to anybody that happens to be in Cambridge. And I spent far more than I should have done. I spent probably so much that if it had been a betting shop, I would have been asked whether I could afford to spend that sort of money or should even think of doing such a thing.
You were the founder of the William Hill Sports Book Award. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yes, if I have any sort of legacy, that's probably it. Almost 30 years ago, exactly now, at which point I'd introduced betting on literary awards to William Hill and to bookmaking, really. The Booker Prize and the Whitbread Prize, as it was at the time, and subsequently there have been quite a lot more. But all of them were what you might call serious literary prizes. And I went to the Sunday Express, either the Sunday or the Daily, I think it was the Sunday Express, sponsored a Book of the Year. And I went to the announcement of the winner, I think it must have been, and I spoke to a few journalists there and said, look, what's the equivalent award for sporting books? And there was general sort of hilarity amongst these highbrow literary critics, the thought that anybody would be remotely interested in reading, let alone giving an award to people that wrote books about sport. And I thought, okay, well, fair enough. So there isn't one. I thought, well, perhaps there should be one. What could I do about making one? And I looked through the budget that we had, that I managed to find a little bit of money, and I thought, okay, if we're going to do this, we'd need a venue. We'd need a venue to do it in. And at the time, it was in Tottenham Court Road, just off of Tottenham Court Road, a shop called Sports Pages Bookshop, which was then the only dedicated sports bookshop in the country, and I don't think there have been any subsequently. The guy that ran it, John Gaustad, an exiled Kiwi, so did have another shop in Manchester eventually, but that didn't last as long as the one in London. Neither of us can remember who arranged to meet who, but we met one day, and it transpired that when we started talking about it, we both had the same idea. We both wanted a sports book of the year. John had had the idea and had a location to hold it, a ceremony for the winning book, but had no budget to put into it. I had a budget, but had no location. Bingo, we had an idea between us. We then looked at each other and thought, who gives a damn what we think are the best sports books of the year? We need a serious judging panel. My budget didn't extend as far as paying well-known sporting figures to adjudicate on the best sports book of the year. So we approached a few people and said, listen, this is our idea, we want to do it. We can't offer you any money. We can offer you a slap-up meal and all you can drink of a night if you want while you decide who's won. Are you interested? And we got back Harry Carpenter, remember the boxing and TV sports commentator, Ian Waldridge of the Daily Mail, Hugh McIlvany, probably the greatest sporting journalist in this country for the last 50-odd years, and Cliff Morgan, the legendary Welsh rugby player and brilliant journalist as well. They all said yes, they'd love to do it. They all said yes, they'd love to do it for nothing. And they all did it for nothing. We launched the award. This year, we're going to award it for the 29th time. So I think the first year that we awarded a winner was 1989. And it was won by a book about the university boat race, written by Dan Topolsky and Patrick Robinson, called True Blue, which was eventually made into a film. Excellent winner. We followed that up in the second year by a book about the Tour de France called Rough Ride by Paul Kimmage, now a very well-known sporting journalist, at which point my managing director of the time, John Brown, started to say to me, you keep giving this award to books that we can't make any flipping money gambling on. He said, who's interested in betting on the outcome of a two-horse race? He said, and cycling? Who'd ever want to bet on that? Well, nowadays we know who'd want to bet on that. A lot of people would want to bet on it, but back in the day, they wouldn't. And we began, you know, we began to create a reputation for the award from the first day. It's now 29 years on, worth £29,000 to the winner. It goes up by £1,000 a year. It's the richest, most prestigious sports book prize in the world. It's spawned its imitators, but authors still value our award above and beyond anything else, as witness last year's winner, William Finnegan, an American, flew over from the States just to find out whether he'd won or not. He didn't know whether he'd won. And 2 years before that, Anna Crean from Australia flew over from Australia. She won with a book called Night Games. We've had some fantastic books have won it. I like to think we've upped the quality of sports books writing, because now it's no longer, you've still got the books by David Beckham, My Life, Age 13 and a Half, and those sort of things. But you've got far, far more depth to sports writing these days and sports book writing. And only yesterday, as we speak, we unveiled the shortlist of seven contenders for this year award, or this year's award, from a long list of 16. We had 131 books entered. I strongly believe that had we not launched the William Hill Sports Book of the Year, by now you would have struggled to buy anything other than books about, you know, sporting superstars that we know already, the Lewis Hamiltons of this world, and the David Beckhams, as I said before, and all, you know, Lester Piggott might get an autobiography, but a lot of other, you know, journeyman jockey who now can write their stories don't. So the interest now is more in the story than in the name of the person that the story is about necessarily. And I think we've it's just been brilliant. I'm delighted that we were able to introduce it. Sadly, John Galstad, my co-founder, died two years ago now, nearly. And I'm now chairman of the judging panel, and the judging panel still has Hugh McIlvany on it all these years on, and also includes John Inverdale, Alison Rudd of The Times, Danny Kelly, the TalkSport broadcaster, Mark Lawson, who used to present the Front Row programme, and Clark Carlisle, the former footballer. So we have a great judging panel. We still don't give them any money, but you shouldn't be at the judging dinner, but you should hear the passion with which they debate the claims of the books. Each of them will go into the judges' dinner with their favourite books that they're determined should come out as the winner. We don't have runners up. There's one winner and six others. It'll be, but they'll battle long and hard, and whoever gets selected as the winner must know that, you know, that's been a very serious discussion, and we've always kept the judging panel as much as possible. We've allowed people to, if they want to step down, that's fine. If they don't, they can stay. And it's that, in a way, it may sound a little bit snooty, possibly, but I thought from the start, you know, our core business was always horse racing, and in horse racing you can trace back the pedigree of horses from here to 1776 or whatever, if you want to do. And I felt that with our sporting award, we'd like to be able to say, unlike some other major literary prizes, like the Booker, for example, where you strongly feel that a book that wins this year's prize, if it came out next year or last year, wouldn't have won it, because they've got a totally different judging panel, and those people just happened on that day to think, okay, well, you know, we're only here for a year, it doesn't really matter if we choose something of this nature, and they might go for a book which they otherwise, you know, another judging panel would look at and discard. At least you can see the pedigree of our award stretching back 29 years, and that's, you know, that's something you can't just invent and throw money at tomorrow. You can't get that credibility, you have to work at it. Yes, we went horse racing with Horse Racing Abroad to Morocco, and we were at the races, I can't remember now, to be honest with you, the name of the race course, but it was just outside Rabat. And we'd sat there, we'd been served a meal. I won't comment too much on the quality of the meal that we were served. It was coming up to the last race of the day, and we were told that the King's horse was running in the last race of the day. And a lot of the people on the table with us thought, okay, King's horse, must be a good thing. A bit like a lot of people who believe every horse the Queen runs over here is going to win. They don't always, but quite a lot of them do. So all of our table rushed off to back this horse owned by the King. I resisted the temptation, basically on figuring it would be odds on anyway, and probably no point. Anyway, the race went off. The King's horse duly won. The people on the table got up to go and collect their winnings. They all came back looking very crestfallen, to be told, to tell us, how much did you win? What price was it? Ah, well, they said, because the King's horse won, all bets were voided, apparently. And so they gave us our money back. Right, and you accepted that, did you? Well, we didn't have much choice, they just gave us our money back. And what about those that backed the losers? Did they get their money back as well then, if all bets on the winner were voided? Oh no, didn't think of that. You better go back and ask them if you backed a loser. At least get your money back. You've obviously been stitched up somehow on the winner. So they went back, they came back up. The guy on that tote window doesn't seem to be there anymore. He's legged it. And he clearly legged it with everything he'd taken on the last race before the shutters. Once the shutters had gone down, he was out the back. I know all this nonsense about voiding the race because the King's horse had won. He made a nice few quid out of Horse Racing Abroad patrons, let alone anybody else that was there on the day. So that was a pretty memorable occasion. That was Africa. I recently went racing in Oslo to see the Norwegian Derby. They only have one race course in Norway, Ovrevoll, which I probably pronounce worse than William Buick would have done. But it was a lovely day, a good crowd, 7,000 people went. We were with HRA this time. Oslo's a lovely city. They organised when we got to the race course that we'd get a chat from a jockey who was riding that afternoon. He was a Spanish lad, English very good. He told us he was riding a 7-1 shot in the fourth or fifth race, and he thought it'd go pretty well. Went better than very well. It won, and he was right. It did return 7-1, so that was profitable. But he'd also told us that the favourite for the Derby had just come out, and that meant that the new favourite was a horse being ridden by a female jockey there, and no female jockey had ever won the Norwegian Derby before. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, if the crowd here is anything like the crowd at a lot of race courses, because it's being ridden by a female jockey, it's probably going to start at a bigger price than it should do, because that female jockey ain't Hayley Turner. So I thought, well, I'll have a few quid on that. It was, went off something like, I don't know, 9-4, I think I managed to get it. Absolutely sloshed up. So that was brilliant. So that was a very profitable afternoon's racing in Norway. I didn't only have one other bet, and that got beat, so 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And we've been in the States, done the Breeders' Cup, done a Melbourne Cup. The Melbourne Cup is probably the one race meeting, if you only have one race meeting you ever want to go to, or you think you are something, go to the Melbourne Cup, because everything you've heard about it is true with knobs on. It's just a fantastic day. Breeders' Cup is great. We've had, you know, one of the worst experiences there, where we saw George Washington break a leg in the Breeders' Cup at Monmouth Park, I think it was that year. We've done the Dubai World Cup, not at Maidan, it must be said, at Nadal Sheba. I haven't done the other one yet. So that was, you know, an Asian race course. Been racing in New Zealand, been racing in Spain, Germany, France. Haven't done Austria and they race sporadically there. I've been raced in East and West Germany. So I can talk that one in. But I haven't, unlike record shops, so I'd like to visit every record shop in this country. I have no desire whatsoever to visit every race course in this country. If it happens, it happens, but I won't make it happen. Last week, 2 weeks ago probably now, I was combining record shopping in Salisbury with a trip to Salisbury races, and that's a lovely course. I can only recommend Salisbury. Hadn't been there before. It is a case, I suppose, that your views are sometimes coloured by whether you backed a winner or not there. Unfortunately, I bumped into a mate of mine who runs a syndicate of owners who told me how well his horse was going to run that afternoon. If finishing seventh is running well, then fine. It ran very well indeed. But if it's not, then I thought, how am I going to get that money back? And in the last race, I noticed that Paul Nichols' daughter was riding a horse in a flat race, the last race of the day, and I thought, well, he's not going to, trained by Paul, and I thought, he's not going to put her on a no-hoper, is he? And I thought, okay, well, is he here? If he's here, that's got to be a double tip. He was there. He was there. You may remember the race. The horse went off, I think, at 9-5. If it had been ridden by a professional male jockey, it would have gone off at 9-5 on. She rode it like a professional jockey. And she rode a brilliant race from the front, which is not easy to do, and she sloshed up by about 5 lengths at 9-5. So, well done, Megan. She's my. Oh, I just wanted to. Can I just give one tribute? Megan Nichols, that was great, and the female jockey in the Norwegian Derby. And I've got to say, my favourite jockey of all jockeys, male, female, whatever else, has to be Nina Carberry. She's got to be the greatest jockey in the world. I've never seen anybody ride and settle horses like she does. I think it's only because she doesn't take it seriously enough to ride professionally, you know, throughout the season, that she's not acknowledged even more so than she is. She's such a brilliant rider, and she's always my go-to jockey, particularly at Cheltenham. You know, when she's riding the race round the... what do they call the course? I forgot what they call it.
Cross country.
The cross country course on a halfway decent horse. She's unbeatable.
So, Graham, you were for 45 years the person behind a lot of the publicity for William Hill. That's when you worked the first few years and you weren't marking the board, etc. So, how did that come to an end? A lot of people were very shocked to the fact that they sort of let you go seemingly so easily.
Well, I'd probably be more shocked that they let me stay so long so easily. 45 years and 1 month, I wasn't really counting, is, you know, it's however you look at it, it's a long old period of time, and there weren't that many people left that had been there that long when I left. There were some, for sure. There's quite a few people out in the shops have been there a good long time, and kudos to them. The company, for reasons best known to itself, decided that they felt that 45 years, 1 month was time enough. Although, to be fair, I do now do some freelance work for the company, particularly related to the William Hill Sports Book of the Year. So we haven't entirely parted company, although I no longer work directly. I'm no longer employed directly by the company. That was their decision. They're fully entitled to take it. I can't say I was 100% in agreement with that decision. But there you go. Ultimately, it wasn't my choice.
So would you say there is a certain aspect of ageism towards older people, especially in sort of trendy PR marketing departments these days?
PR has always been the sort of industry that thrives on a younger image, or likes to. I would say, and I suppose I would say at this end of my career, there is no substitute for experience. And the principles of PR, as with a lot of other things, are the same whether you are 19 years old and just starting out in that industry, or in your 50s or 60s, having been in it for some while. The art of it remains telling a story in such a way that the media will be interested in it. And that's what it boils down to. That's how it is. And I don't think you have to be any particular age to do it. But likewise, I don't think that when you are of a certain age, you're no longer capable of doing it, because it isn't as such a physical occupation. So therefore, Well, we all understand that there aren't going to be Premier League footballers that are in their 60s. That's the physical reason, it's not a mental reason. But at the same time, there are plenty of very good young operators out there doing bookmaker PR, and some of the very best ones still work for William Hill. So, you know, that you can't stand in the way of progress, and you know that ultimately nobody can stay in a job forever. There comes a point at which, if you decide to leave, you know, you can leave the company in the lurch, and then it's your fault, isn't it? You turn around and say, listen, I'm off, I've had enough of this, I can't be bothered to do it any longer, then you're entitled to do that, and the company has to take the risk that you will. I think William Hill has changed radically in those 45 years. It'd be a strange company if it hadn't. And back in the day, it was new and exciting. Now everybody's, you know, doing that type of thing. So you could argue from that perspective, it's tougher to make your way in it. But I suspect people will find new ways of reinventing the industry. I have no serious argument after 45 years in the industry, but that it was an industry that treated me well and a company that treated me well. So it came to a natural end, I suppose, and that's all there is to it.
Right, so you're not involved anymore, but how do you see with the internet? Did you see the future of bookmaking progressing positively?
I see an industry which is under more pressure from different areas than perhaps it has ever been before. It's moved into a lot of different areas which some of the earlier paragons of the industry might not approve if they saw them today, but that in a way is to do with the way in which the world has changed, you know, and technology has changed, and you can't stand still. If you were still a betting shop only taking bets on racing and greyhound racing, you're probably not going to be a bookmaker for very long these days. So it had to move on, and so I played my own part in expanding the range of markets that bookmakers could bet on. But political pressures now impinge on the industry probably in a much stronger way than they ever did before. Maybe not entirely for bookmaking's of bookmaking's doing, you know, unlike the National Lottery, bookmaking, certainly in my experience, never ever campaigned to allow 16 and 17 year olds to get involved. So I think it's been an industry which has obviously had its, will always have its critics. All industries make money out of people, otherwise you couldn't have industries, but few of them do it as blatantly in a way as bookmakers, you know, where you walk into a bookmaker with a tenner, put it over the counter and you walk out with nothing, or you walk out with 100 quid maybe, but more often you'll probably walk out with nothing. But most people that walk in with a tenner understand that they could well walk out with nothing. But it's, you know, it's an industry which in that respect is never going to court or have popularity because of its very nature. But that doesn't mean that it's not entitled to respect from people for what it does, the number of people that it employs, the enjoyment it gives to the vast majority of people, and the very, very small people, a number of people who are adversely affected by what the industry does.
It's not just online betting at Star Sports. You can call us too on 08000 5-1 3-1 and speak directly to one of our friendly and experienced traders. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.